Browse the aisle of any store and you'll not only notice different products for women, but different prices.
They have a new line of pens called Bic for Her. We've been using man pens all these years. Yeah. And they're just like regular pens, except they're pink, so they cost twice as much. That is absolutely true as well.
Ellen DeGeneres can joke, but for many, the so-called pink tax is no laughing matter. We talk about a new state law that will help end some of the discrimination. Plus, Governor Rauner kicked off what will be a year of celebrating our state's 200th birthday.
This is the most wonderful home we could possibly have. And this is our chance to celebrate all the wonderful things that the great people of Illinois have achieved.
We'll learn what's to come for the state bicentennial. But first, why pro-life groups are suing over the state's new abortion law, and whether the Children's Health Insurance Program will survive. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. State and local candidates have until 5 p.m. today to file their petitions to run for office. So while we usually talk state politics on Mondays, this week we're saving it for tomorrow, so we really know who's in and who's out. In the meantime, there's no shortage of news happening in the world of healthcare in Illinois. Last week, pro-life groups sued state officials over a new law that will expand access to abortion. And just yesterday, the drugstore chain CVS made an agreement to buy health insurance company Aetna for $69 billion, a deal that will have a huge effect on the industry nationally. Here in Illinois, Governor Rauner put the finishing touches on a Medicaid overhaul that will cost about $15 billion. And all the while, the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, is hanging in the balance after Congress let the program expire at the end of September. On the line from Chicago to talk about this is Kristen Schorsch. She's a healthcare reporter with Crane's Chicago Business. Kristen, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you again. Let's start with House Bill 40. This is legislation that Governor Rauner signed into law earlier this year. For the first time here, it covers abortions for women on Medicaid and who have insurance through state employment. It would also keep abortion legal in Illinois if the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade. Most conservatives, though, were not happy about the governor signing this. And last Thursday, eight state lawmakers, nearly a dozen anti-abortion groups as well, filed a lawsuit in an attempt to stop the law from taking effect. Kristen, what's their argument?
Right. Well, right. This lawsuit was filed downstate in Sangamon County. They allege that Illinois hasn't earmarked dollars to cover the elective abortions for folks on Medicaid and for state employees and their dependents. So they're essentially saying the state has not funded this law. They're also saying that this is kind of a technicality, but because state lawmakers passed House Bill 40 after May 31, the technical of the law, even if it is funded, shouldn't begin until June 1 of 2018. So they have two separate arguments, but the main one is that the state has not funded this.
So, I mean, this is the question of funding. I mean, I think about state appropriations bills. There's not necessarily line items to fund every sort of medical procedure you can imagine. Do we have a sense of whether this lawsuit really has a chance of going anywhere?
I mean, I think it's a really good question. You know, I think we're just going to have to play out and see what happens. Some of the other interesting numbers that they're citing in their lawsuit is that they're alleging that under House Bill 40, people in Illinois would have to pay for 20,000 to 30,000 abortions per year with taxpayer dollars. Now, right now, they're basically getting those numbers by essentially pegging that to the number of abortions that are on the national rate of abortions that are performed on women on Medicaid. And they're saying that because the price tag in Illinois for an abortion for women on Medicaid is between $750 and $1,000, that's where they're getting those numbers. So I think we're just going to have to see how this plays out in terms of if this is going to be stopped by January 1, which is when the law is supposed to become effective.
Yeah, well, and of course, Democrats will say that actually carrying a pregnancy to term is a lot more expensive even than that would be. You mentioned January 1 is when this law takes effect. What is the timeline on this lawsuit? We're running out of time here.
Well, right. I mean, we're just going to have to see how the state responds. Right. I mean, we only have a few more weeks to go until the law becomes effective. So if not, and this lawsuit actually does get a hearing in court, they're hoping to put it off at least until June 1.
Okay. Well, let's switch gears now, talk about Governor Rauner's Medicaid overhaul. The idea here is to eventually have 80% of Illinoisans in the Medicaid program to be covered through what's called managed care. Kristen, what is managed care? How is this different from how someone's health insurance would normally work if you were on Medicaid?
Right. Well, so the governor believes that the way to save Medicaid dollars is to further privatize it. That's called managed care. So essentially, in managed care, private insurance companies administer the medical benefits for Medicaid recipients. You know, think of a person at work who has Blue Cross insurance. Blue Cross is administering those benefits for you. In this instance, an insurance company would do it instead of Medicaid. They also take it a step further and they focus on prevention. So the idea is to help Medicaid recipients get healthier. They get cancer screenings on time. They want to see a regular doctor instead of using the ER for, let's say, a common cold or the flu. All of this is a goal of saving the state money. Right now, there are about 3.1 million people in Illinois on Medicaid. Nearly two-thirds of them are covered by managed care at this point, and the governor wants to increase that to at least 80%.
So, okay, we're talking about private insurers administering public benefits here. Who pays for what under this plan then?
Right. Well, so the state bid out contracts and it was believed to be the largest procurement in the state. So the governor has recently just signed contracts with seven insurers that are even part of managed care. The new revamped program begins on January 1. These contracts are worth about $15 billion a year. It's taxpayer dollars for 4 years. That's how long the initial contracts last. But the state says that because they rebid these contracts and because they're adding more people to it, and because insurance companies have essentially agreed to be paid less money by the state, that overall the state believes they're actually going to save $1 million over 4 years, essentially over the first batch of these contracts because they're four-year terms.
Well, I mean, that sounds like a good savings, and yet we're hearing Democrats saying that costs are going up and they tried to put the brakes on this with some legislation in the veto session. What's the opposition here?
Right. I mean, lawmakers believe that this has not been transparent enough. I mean, they want to see more scrutiny by lawmakers, especially when these contracts were bid out. Some lawmakers have been pushing to audit these private insurance companies, which are known as managed care organizations. They want to make sure that they're doing a good job and that they're actually saving the state money. So there has been a back and forth between critics and the governor's administration since February, which is when he announced that he wanted to essentially overhaul managed care and make it better.
Okay, so let's just kind of bring this to a close. What will, if you're actually in the Medicaid program, you're going to be one of these people who's moved into a managed care, what sort of changes might one expect to see?
Right. Well, folks should be getting a letter in the mail any day now, essentially telling them, here are the private insurers in managed care that you can pick from, depending on where you live. And so depending on what part of the state you live in, it should start around January 1, and you'll basically have potentially a new insurance company. So you might not be able to see, depending on the networks that these insurance companies have, you might be able to still see the doctors you like. You might not have to switch to a new doctor. You might be able to still go to the hospital in your community, or you might have to go to a different one. It all depends on the doctors and the hospitals that are contracting with these insurance companies. So people on Medicaid who are choosing which private insurer to sign up for should definitely make sure and try and find out which doctors and hospitals that they prefer if they're in these networks or not.
Okay, that's Kristen Schorsch, healthcare reporter for Crain's Chicago Business. Kristen, thanks as always for joining us on the 21st.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
As we mentioned earlier, there's movement related to healthcare on the national level. Of course, Republicans in Washington have been working on a tax bill, and the Senate version of that bill, which passed this weekend, gets rid of crucial parts of the Affordable Care Act. We'll be talking more about the implications of the tax bill later this week, But we wanted to set aside some time to talk about the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. It's designed to provide health insurance for kids who need it, but whose family incomes are just high enough that they don't qualify for Medicaid. 9 million kids get health insurance through this program. In Illinois, that's 180,000 children, and Congress let the program expire at the end of September. Joining me now is Jenny Pinkwater, Executive Director of the Illinois Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Jenny, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So who are the kids in Illinois that are served through CHIP?
So CHIP is basically an extension program of Medicaid. So it's really designed to be a supplemental program and really cover the working poor. So those families who are working jobs where they may not qualify or the jobs may not offer family insurance, but also make too much to qualify for Medicaid. So it's really that bridge between Medicaid and private insurance is where CHIP lies and is really beneficial in terms of making sure that children are covered throughout the country and in Illinois.
So this is like a sort of a piece of the puzzle in between the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid and private insurance. It's just kind of trying to keep people from falling through the cracks, I guess you might say.
Yes, exactly. I mean, generally our insurance program to cover children consists of Medicaid, CHIP, the Marketplace or Obamacare, the ACA, and then our private insurance and then employer insurance. And so CHIP is really the bridge between folks that make too much for Medicaid but too little to purchase on the Marketplace or through their insurer, through their employer.
So this might seem like kind of an obvious question, but why do you think this program is important?
Well, it's really important to keep children covered. And CHIP is really credited with making sure that we have increased our overall insurance rate. In Illinois, we actually exceed U.S. rates. We're at about 97% of children covered through insurance, a variety of different insurance. In Illinois, we have about 1.4 million, 1.5 million children covered under Medicaid, and about 200,000 to 300,000 of those are covered through CHIP. So it's really that bridge place. And when we see CHIP go away, we see really the working poor and the working families be able to lose their insurance coverage, which can lead to catastrophic bills and lack of just general coverage. It's, in pediatrics and as pediatricians, we really look for preventative care, so making sure people are getting their immunizations and going to the doctor regularly to identify issues, either through medical issues or things like developmental screening or delays. And it's really important that children continue to be covered on insurance to be able to access those physicians.
Mm-hmm. So if I remember correctly, you were on the show in, September, I think, to talk about CHIP before Congress let the funding deadline pass. Were you surprised when the Congress did not renew CHIP on time?
I was. We've been talking about CHIP reauthorization now for about a little over a year. And traditionally, CHIP has always been a bipartisan program. It has been supported by Republicans and Democrats in its history. Certainly at the beginning of the year, we're still feeling very positive in terms of CHIP reauthorization. A lot of what's been going on in D.C. Has really been derailed through conversations around repeal of the ACA and now within tax reform, and CHIP has kind of been pushed to the side. So it's getting more and more concerning the closer we get to the end of the year, especially in other states as they're starting to announce that they're running out of funds to continue to cover coverage to cover children under CHIP.
We should mention that we contacted the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services. They told us that CHIP in Illinois can continue as is through September of 2018 without more federal funding. Jenny, what are you hearing from doctors and parents about the future of CHIP? Are they still optimistic that Congress can extend this program?
In general, we continue to be optimistic. It's right now we're hopeful that the CHIP reauthorization will be included in some of the tax bills and things like that are going on in D.C. right now to renew overall funding for the government. And our national office continues to work diligently with other groups to work with legislators to make sure that CHIP program does continue. We are lucky here in Illinois that our department and our state has really made an effort to make sure people understand that they can continue to be enrolled and covered under CHIP for some time. But other states are already announcing that they're going to run out of funding for CHIP and may have to start shutting down their program. So we haven't heard that here in Illinois, which is great news.
What are you worried might happen if the program isn't reauthorized?
If the program isn't reauthorized, states are really going to have to start to examine whether they'll be able to continue to use state funds to cover those children. So some states have been able to reallocate funds to continue to do that. Other states have chosen to start to try to end their programs and are starting to send out announcements. Some states might put a freeze on the program, which can be detrimental in terms of people being able to access it. Certainly as people lose jobs or gain jobs, people go in and off insurance programs all the time, and so when you put a freeze on it, it certainly stops the ability to do that. If CHIP is not reauthorized and states aren't able to fund it, then unfortunately many of those programs are going to end and children will have to be able to find insurance in a different way.
Have we heard anything particularly in Illinois about this? I mean, this is the state that came up with All Kids a decade ago.
Yeah, I mean, as the department said, they've been stating that they'll be able to fund CHIP at least through 2018, so we're very excited and positive about that news. But it does continue to make sure that we will get funding, especially at the beginning of next year, so we can continue to make sure that those children are covered and that folks know that they can continue. You know, the stability of insurance and people knowing what they can do and what they can access is really important. And so we really want to make sure that our federal counterparts are making sure that they understand the importance of CHIP in having children's health.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my question. If you could, and we only have about a minute left, if you could, you know, send a message to Washington about CHIP, what would it be?
It's really important to continue. I think everyone is very passionate in making sure children get their help they need, and certainly CHIP is a very key component to that in bridging that gap between Medicaid and private insurance, and is really important for the working poor.
All right, Jenny Pinkwater, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jenny Pinkwater is Executive Director of the Illinois Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Back in 1992, a book came out with the title Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. That may or may not be true, but one thing's for certain, whichever planet women are from, it's definitely more expensive to live there. Whether you're talking about shampoo or dry cleaning, women have historically always paid more, despite statistically earning less than men. How much more? According to Consumer Reports, gendered pricing costs women almost $1,400 extra a year for the exact same products purchased by men. But a new Illinois law goes into effect on January 1st. It's intended to chip away at some of those gender discrepancies. The legislation makes it illegal for businesses like dry cleaners and salons to charge more to provide their services to women. So, does this mean we're close to an end of the so-called pink tax? And how are retailers and manufacturers responding when it comes to the consumer power of women and girls? We'll address some of those questions in a minute, but first, State Senator Melinda Bush sponsored this new law. She's a Democrat representing the 31st District in much of central and northern Lake County. She's on the line with us from Grays Lake in Lake County, about 40 miles north of downtown Chicago. Senator Bush, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, Senator. So what with this law, what is going to change for women consumers after January 1st?
Well, the law amends the Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Practices Act. It provides that dry cleaners, barbers, and tailors have to provide price lists for standard services upon request. So this means that you know, they have their pricing. I don't know if you've ever gone in any of these places, but generally the prices aren't posted. So you don't know up front what you're going to be paying for many of these services. So these industries will be required to have available price lists on their services.
So how is this enforced? I mean, is it up to the consumer to see the price difference and ask about it now that businesses will have to be more transparent? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a bill about transparency. We negotiated last year. The bill started out when I first started working on the bill. I wanted to basically do what California had done earlier, which was to make that illegal. Through some negotiations, what we did is made it a transparency bill. So courts will have an authority to impose a civil penalty in a sum up to $50,000 if these prices are not made available and if it's deemed that these prices, are being implemented and are discriminatory.
I wonder, do you have a personal experience of, because I mean, this was news to me when I learned about dry cleaning rates. Yeah. It was an example that stuck in my head. I mean, do you have a personal experience of when you sort of realized that this was happening?
Yeah. So it kind of, evolved over time for me. So I got really interested in gender pricing and gender inequity when I passed a bill called the Pink Tax a few years back that dealt with the taxation of feminine hygiene products. I got really interested in pricing in general and read in depth. There was a study that was done in New York, I believe in 2015, called Cradle to the Grave, Cradle to Cane. And there were a lot of pricing comparisons done there where you could literally see that women were paying more for things because they were pink, because they were being sold to women. We've done the transparency really did make a difference, though, talking about these issues. I won't name the retailer, but there were items, large retailers where they were charging for a child's pink item $49 and the male counterpart $24. Those prices have changed online. They're much closer together. So I think this awareness is really, really important. But that really piqued my interest. And I can tell you, I think every woman out there that has items dry cleaned can address this. When I bring in a suit coat for my partner, who happens to be male, I probably pay $5 or $6 to have that item clean. When I bring in a suit coat for myself, I'm probably going to pay $10 to have that item cleaned. The same thing goes for shirts. You see many times, dry cleaners will run advertising where they're talking, you can get your shirts done for 99 cents. I take a blouse in, it costs me $5 or $6. So certainly it's something that I've been aware of throughout my life. We pay more certainly for other services, haircuts, those kinds of things. But for me, my personal experiences were really it was the dry cleaners that really made me think, we've got to make sure that we are not paying more for something just because we're women.
Yeah, sure. So you mentioned a moment ago that you worked to repeal the state sales tax on feminine hygiene products last year.
Yep.
Why is this such an important area for you to try and improve for women?
Well, because it's an absolute necessity. Women that live in, we make less, we get paid less, and yet this is an absolute necessity. And there were so many other countries that had gotten rid of the taxes on feminine hygiene products. These were being charged at luxury tax levels. So in Chicago, those tax rates were just under 10%. Certainly in the rest of the state, close to 7%. They weren't even in the same category as food. So I really felt that this was not just about that tax, although that's really important. I think it's really more of a statement that we're trying to say that women are no longer going to stand back and pay more for taxation or pay more on items simply because we are women. It's unfair. We want equity.
So as we mentioned, this only applies to gender parity when it comes to certain services, but there are still a lot
Correct.
Of ways in which women spend more than men. Illinois hasn't done a comprehensive study, but as you mentioned, the New York City Department of Consumer Affairs had that report that found that a women's products cost, 7% more than the male analog. So how does this leave women vulnerable?
Well, it leaves us vulnerable because we still make less. We all know that. And particularly, women make less than men. Period, no pun intended. But women of color make even less than white women, frankly, and it leaves us vulnerable because we're paying more, 7% more, over our lifetime on like items. You know, we're talking shaving razors, things that they literally, it's why it's become known as the pink tax. Many times these things are made in the color pink to be attractive to women. Sometimes the item itself may still be blue, but the packaging might be pink. We're being advertised to and paying more for those products over our lifetime while we're still making less. And this is something that should concern men too, you know, because if women are not doing well, no one's doing well.
So last question, do you think, I mean, speaking of pink razor blades, do you think retailers and manufacturers are going to respond to laws like this, or is the biggest change maker going to have to be the marketplace?
I think it's a combination of the both. Truly. Once the study was done and people started to talk about it, you know, I did an interview with a news station on the pink tax and on gender pricing. And frankly, I named a large company who had a price of $49 for the Radio Flyers Girl for scooter and a price of $24 for the boys for the red, literally a $25 price difference. I can tell you that that retailer changed the prices online within a few weeks after that appeared. Their price today, there's a $5 difference. You know, so there may be at times a manufacturing issue where maybe they're making less of them. And that's certainly justifiable, but it's not justifiable to gouge women simply because you can. So I think the awareness really does make a difference, and I think we can speak with our pocketbooks. Many women don't buy pink razor blades. They buy the black ones because they know they're the same. The color's different. So we can certainly speak with our pocketbooks, but we can speak with our mouths, and we can let people know, let the manufacturers know, let the retailers know that we are not going to pay more for services unless there's a justifiable reason for it.
Senator Bush, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much. And happy holidays to you and everyone else.
You too. I've been speaking with State Senator Melinda Bush on the 21st. Let's bring in Catherine Tradel into the conversation. She's a clinical professor in the Department of Marketing at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University in Chicago. Her work focuses on gender norms in emerging markets. She's on the line with us now from Chicago. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Professor Tradel, we've been talking about women paying more for many services than men, but when it comes to products, what are some of the biggest examples where the women's versions are more expensive?
Oh, yes, this is an important issue that my students and I have researched. Senator Bush covered some important areas, including personal care. We've also found a big difference in the area of perfumes, luxury perfumes, for example. So the same type of perfume, the same brand, the same size for men costs $92. For women, it's $125.
So
it's $33 more for women.
Yeah, so perfumes, this also applies to more everyday items like deodorant, shampoo, right? Yeah.
Razors, yeah. Blue jeans, deodorant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why have these unique gender-specific markets developed?
I think that gender marketing is twofold. For one, we like to express our gender, of course, men and women do. And second, gendering products is a way to grow markets for companies. And that's totally ethical and normal. The problem comes in when the prices become different for men and women. And it's very hard as consumers to see through all of the differences that are presented to us, like product benefits. Maybe the men's one is presented as working for 36 hours straight. The women's would have a different benefit, like it is good for the skin and your underarms, right? And when we see those two benefits, it's sort of and different prices. Well, that means we have to do a lot of research to find it, and it's hard to say, oh, well, is one benefit worth the extra price, and so on and so forth.
So the men are out there riding the range, I guess, and need the longevity of the powerful deodorant, and the women want their delicate skin to be treated gingerly. You know, moving on to services, whether we're talking about like dry cleaning, right? Because the clothes, you know, you get into this argument where the clothes are more complicated for women, or you know, special scents with shampoo. It's kind of become an acceptable practice. I wondered, why do you think women have accepted these price differences?
Well, a lot of women buy men's products and personal care because it's less expensive, and a lot of women have accepted it so far because it takes a lot of work to go through and compare things and see the difference. And then, you know, maybe you don't want to buy deodorant that makes you smell like a man, so you end up buying the woman's.
So,
then there's that. Maybe you don't have that much of a choice. You can also buy more gender-neutral brands that are coming out on the market now, like Aesop from Australia. Those tend to be much more expensive.
So that doesn't necessarily solve the problem we're talking about. I mean, from a marketing or, you know, from a consumer standpoint, do you think women like having their own unique things, or is this more that women have been sort of conditioned or told to want their own unique?
I think men like to express their gender, and I think men do too. The problem is we don't like as women to be told we should pay more for expressing that. And there's a lot of advertising that tells us, express your gender. But then when we go to the store and find out that we have to pay more to express that, that's unsettling.
Okay, I'm speaking with Professor Catherine Tradel on the 21st about the cost of being a female consumer. Let's talk now about children and girls. Do girls' products tend to be more expensive?
Unfortunately, they do, yes. I think that Senator Bush was talking about toys. That's definitely the case. It's also the case for products that, for other products like clothes. So for underwear, a pack of what would be called classic cotton briefs for boys would be one price, and the girls' package is 80 cents more.
So you mentioned a trend toward more gender-neutral products in adults, or at least an option for gender-neutral products in adults. I think we can say that maybe that's a trend for children. What successful examples of this are you aware of?
There's some good brands for children, and it's especially important for kids' clothes, because if you have a family with a boy and a girl, you want to keep some clothes for the hand-me-downs, right? So there are a few brands that have come out for children for more gender-neutral clothes. There are some personal care brands, as I said, for adults that are more gender neutral, or they would be called unisex, I think. Again, these are much more expensive. Those are positive changes, though, to get away from the gender pricing.
Sure. Well, as we wrap up, you spend a lot of time, as many people in colleges and universities do, teaching young adults and millennials. They will be the ones making and influencing these consumer and marketing decisions in the future. I'm wondering, do you see opportunities for positive change?
I think so. I think as these millennials get into managerial positions and make the decisions, they'll be able to move things either to more gender neutral or make the prices even for things that are gendered. Yes, they're much more, as we say, woke about the prices of things reflecting unfair parts of our society.
Okay. Yes. Well, Catherine Tradel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure. Have a nice afternoon.
You too. Catherine Tradel is a clinical professor in the Department of Marketing at the Quinlan School of Business, Loyola University, Chicago. And just a reminder, if you have questions or comments about what we're talking about, you can always find us on Facebook by searching The 21st. Follow us on Twitter at 21stshow. You can always leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. Coming up next on the 21st, Illinois starts celebrating its 200th birthday. We'll talk about what to expect with Deputy Governor Leslie Munger and Illinois Tourism Director Corey Job. We'll get into all of that on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Illinois celebrated a birthday yesterday. It was 199 years ago that we became the 21st state, name check, though I swear it doesn't look a day over 180. Sunday was also the kickoff of a year-long celebration commemorating the Illinois Bicentennial. The next year will be filled with a variety of different events, and there's a musical centered around 1776, a Route 66 motorcycle ride. It all culminates with a gala next December at the United Center. Joining us to discuss the festivities are Deputy Governor Leslie Munger and Illinois Tourism Director Corey Jobe. They're on the line from Chicago. Leslie, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
And Corey, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us on.
So, Leslie, I'll begin with you. There are anniversaries of things all the time. Why is it important to you to get people excited about Illinois' 200th birthday?
Well, we certainly don't get an opportunity to celebrate our 200th birthday very often. And this is really, I think, a great opportunity for all of us around the state to stop and just think about what we are proud about in the state of Illinois. And we've had a lot of challenges over the last several years. But when you talk to people around the state, so many are proud of Illinois' rich heritage, proud because they were born here or grew up here, went to school here, built their businesses here. And so this is an opportunity for us to remember, to celebrate all the wonderful things about Illinois, all of our firsts. There are many. We have four presidents that have come from Illinois. We are the birthplace of the ice cream sundae and the first skyscraper and Tootsie Rolls and radio flyers, and among other things. And to say we're proud to be from Illinois and to really set us on a great path for our next 200 years.
Yeah, so I can picture it now, a wagon filled with Tootsie Rolls coming out of the Willis Tower. Corey, Illinois is such a diverse state with so many different communities, right? North, south, urban, rural. How do you bring different people together to celebrate?
Well, I think that's one of one of the many great assets about Illinois. It's such a big state. There are so many different, unique experiences. You know, as the state's tourism director, we have the honor and the responsibility of marketing the state and all of our great sites, attractions, communities to potential visitors from around the Midwest, around the Great Lakes states, around the U.S. and the world. Last year alone, we welcomed 112 million visitors to the state of Illinois, and 87% of those visitors were here for leisure purposes. So this gives us a great opportunity to really connect visitors to something they might not have visited before. I think I know the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Obviously, President Lincoln is a well-known figure, not only around the Midwest, but from around the world. And then you have Ulysses S. Grant's home in Galena, Ronald Reagan's roots in Eureka and Dixon, and then obviously President Obama with making his announcement and his vice presidential pick at the state capital, the old state capitol in Springfield, and his follow his roots leading up to his soon-to-be-open Presidential Library and Learning Center here scheduled in Chicago in 2021. So there's a lot of great opportunities to really connect individuals with historical activities that have happened, and there are great sites around the state. About 58% of our visitors who traveled Illinois for leisure are within the state. So, you know, when you think about Chicago and all the millions of people who live in Chicago and the suburban area, this gives us an opportunity to connect them to downstate and some of the unique points of interest along the way in the coming year with the Bicentennial celebration.
So, Leslie, as the former controller of Illinois, you are uniquely qualified to know how bad the state's finances are. You mentioned some of the challenges we face. I've got to think there are going to be a lot of people out there who hear about a celebration and think, Illinois peaked with Lincoln. What are we celebrating right now?
Well, I think if we look back at our history, there have been many, many challenges that we've had in the state, and we have come through them, and we have gotten past them and have thrived. And you certainly look around the industry in our state. We are one of the largest economies, not only in the country, but in the world. We have all of the Class 1 rail lines converge in Illinois. You can go anywhere coast to coast from our great airports. We have abundant fresh water. We have rich farm fields. We have great universities and a very skilled workforce, and we have many, many things to be proud of. And so, we get bogged down in the negatives, day to day, but when we step back and look at where we started, really a wild part of the country with not a lot of industry to one of the powerhouses, we can say we've really come a long way. And one of the things that we're trying to do is we look at this. Corey mentioned traveling some around the historic sites, reconnecting people to all the things that really make Illinois great, celebrating the diversity of our state from the Chicago area down to the beautiful Shawnee National Forest in southern Illinois, which, if you closed your eyes, you think you're in Utah in Bryce Canyon. We have a wonderful, beautiful state. And so I think this is an opportunity for Illinoisans all around the state to reconnect with the state and to celebrate and to say we're great and we are going to be even better in the next 200 years.
Corey, you talked about the presidents who are from Illinois. What other areas or events in Illinois history do you think are important that people should try and connect to?
Well, I mean, you talk about all the great the architecture scene. One of the things I love about Illinois, and I talk a lot about this when we're talking to the international potential international tour operators and visitors who are coming to Chicago and around the state, when we mention great famed architects like Frank Lloyd Wright and the footprint and the lasting legacy he has had on people think of Chicago and Oak Park, but the lasting footprint that he has in Rockford, in Springfield, and other communities around Kankakee, other communities around Illinois, and then here in Chicago in terms of just fantastic architecture. And I think the ability, I go back to what Leslie said a minute ago, our diverse state, all the different unique experiences that a visitor, when they're coming to Illinois, I mean, you think about it, 112 million visitors in 2016 that came to Illinois, that's a lot of people crisscrossing the state and enjoying really what we're known for, and that's this Midwestern great hospitality, very affordable, very welcoming, and you can have a world-class city with all the great amenities and quickly take a road trip and be on historic Route 66 or six of our other national scenic byways and experiencing great history and outdoor adventure. And then living like a local in so many small communities around the state. It's really a complete, I call it a complete bucket list. When you think of all that people think of Illinois, when people think of going on a vacation, they think of the East Coast or West Coast. But when you put the itinerary in front of a visitor, there's a lot of things to see and do, and you can check a lot of you can put a lot of check marks on that bucket list, and we see that day in and day out. And I think just having the opportunity to celebrate our past successes, and whether that's in business or in education, whether that's in tourism, or there's a lot of great ways that we can capitalize on that in the coming year and celebrate all that and share that with the world.
So, Leslie, I want to ask you in a more straightforward way than I did earlier, maybe, how are we paying for this? If people are wondering, Illinois, like we said, is in a time of financial crisis.
Everything we're doing with the Bicentennial is 100% funded through donations and sponsorships. We have a number of our state's companies, corporations that are stepping up and supporting us. Our first 100-day countdown to the Bicentennial, which we just wrapped up, was sponsored by BMO Harris Bank. It allowed us to have a contest where we engaged students, high school and college students all around the state of Illinois, to do videos and submit them for something to learn about Illinois history. Of the many, many videos we received, we chose 100 that we aired. We aired one every day of the 100-day countdown. And yesterday, those students were able to join us and with a guest for the performance, the matinee performance of Hamilton, where we did another curtain raising, if you will, on the bicentennial. So we have sponsorships in that way. We have a number of corporations who are sponsoring various events throughout the year, but it's all funded through sponsorships and donations, no tax dollars.
So you mentioned the Illinois Pride competition, the history competition there, and Corey, you a couple minutes ago gave a long list of many things that people can do in Illinois, and I think that's kind of encapsulates your job is trying to sell Illinois as a tourist destination. But we're in an environment where there are a lot of forces that want to make the state look like a disaster for political purposes. We had Governor Bruce Rauner tweeting last month that Illinois is at the edge of disaster, and he's running an ad with neighboring governors. How do you deal with those headwinds when you are selling Illinois generally and for the bicentennial?
Well, I can say over the last 10 years, Illinois' tourism economy has just continued to grow. In the last 2 years alone, we created a little over 20,000 new tourism-related jobs in the economy. No matter what, people still want to travel. Whatever the temperature is, in politics, I'll leave that to people above my pay grade. But people like to travel. Families like to hop in the car, disconnect from the mobile phones and the laptops and enjoy each other. If the economy is great, they might want to travel a little further or extend their trips. But if the belts are a little tight, they stay closer to home, and that gives us all sorts of great opportunities. The numbers speak for themselves. It was 112 million visitors to the state last year. We're on par to eclipse that again in 2017. And again, I go back to the fact that people still want to travel. We are an international hub, not only for business, but for tourism as well. You know, we're prominently in the markets of the UK, Germany, Japan, China, and Mexico. We partner very closely with choose Chicago and the city of Chicago and attracting international visitors from around the world. And we are still a key destination point for all those things I talked about earlier. And in tourism numbers, it's a major economic engine for the state. The fourth largest employer is the tourism and hospitality industry. And as we all know, small business owners are really the backbone of our state's economy, and many of our small business owners rely very heavily on the tourism industry and provide a lot of goods and services to the visitor who is coming into the community and the state.
Well, you mentioned you're going to leave politics to somebody above your pay grade. We just so happen to have her on the line, Deputy Governor Munger. I wonder, because the governor is at competing odds here, right? When he does want to celebrate the bicentennial, he's been doing events this week, and I'm sure he will continue to be doing events for the next year. But he also has a political message, which, you know, is a sincerely held belief. I don't mean to minimize it, that there are a lot of things that he wants to see changed in Illinois. How do you walk that line?
Well, I don't think these things are mutually exclusive. We have a rich history. We have come a long way since the founding of our state. But we have a long way we can go. And I think it's fair to say that, I think if anyone's read the paper, they know the financial challenges of the state. I can say as the former state controller, you know, there are a lot of bills waiting to be paid in the state. So I think what you hear from the governor is a call for fiscal responsibility so we can have the kind of future that the state ought to be able to have, and really trying to get everyone in the state on a page of looking forward so that we can be a state that pays its bills on time. It has economic growth consistent with being a large economy in the center of the continent with the world-class resources that we have. We could do better than we are, but the bicentennial is really about celebrating the 200 years of success that we've had, helping people be proud about our state, remind everyone why they're proud about our state. And I'll tell you, when you talk to Illinoisans, all around the state, they will tell you, I'm here because I was born here. This is my home. I built my company here. I grew up here. I went to school here, and I never left. And while we have our challenges, the purpose of the bicentennial is to celebrate how far we've come.
Corey Jobe is the Illinois Tourism Director. Leslie Munger is Deputy Governor of Illinois. Happy Illinois birthday. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great
day. Thanks for having us.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. And all of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, social media, it's on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.